Well, nice to meet some of you, and glad I could be here. Brian Tallman is my name. I pastor New Life Presbyterian Church, La Mesa. I was saying earlier that if you've ever been to the conference before, our church used to host the IBCD conference in June, so perhaps you've been down there in La Mesa. There is an outline, should be an outline there. You have that, and I'll try to stick to that pretty closely. And I'll also try to leave some time for us to have some questions and sort of a lecture format, so I'll stick pretty close to my notes, but if it's urgent, you know, if you want to raise your hand or something, that's fine. See how it all works out here. So the topic and the title is The Lord's Supper as Preemptive Peacemaking. It seems to me that Americans know how to feed, but do not know how to eat. Leon Cass is a medical doctor who I think is also a Christian by the way that he writes. And he has written an interesting book on eating and the philosophy of eating. It's called The Hungry Soul. Another one, parenthetically, if you're interested on the philosophy of eating, which I've been interested now for some time, is called The Supper of the Lamb, by Robert Capone, C-A-P-O-N. It's actually a cookbook and a philosophy of eating. He's a Christian, and it's a fascinating read. But Leon Cass rightly alerted us to our reductionist tendencies when it comes to eating. He said this: we face serious dangers from our increasingly utilitarian, functional, or economic attitudes toward food. True, fast food, TV dinners, and eating on the run save time, meet our need for fuel, and provide close to instant gratification. But for these very reasons, they diminish opportunities for conversation, communion, and aesthetic discernment. They thus shortchange the other hungers of the soul. According to Cass, then, feeding is what animals do, and eating is what humans do. Animals eat primarily for food. He actually makes a big deal that the animals, when they eat, they actually look down. And that when we eat, we look heavenward. We bless God. There's more to our eating than just feeding. There's more to our eating than just fuel. We eat for fuel, but we also eat for a whole host of social dimensions, including, as Cass noted, conversation, communion, and aesthetic discernment. Now, interestingly enough, when one surveys the scriptures, we find eating, feasting, and dining to play a very prominent role in scripture. And the goal of those events is never just merely feeding, just merely to get fuel. Instead, these times of feasting and dining are profoundly spiritual events. One thinks of the famous verse, whatever you do, do all, whether it's eating or drinking, do all the glory of God, comes right, and as we'll see, in the heart of the context of the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 10:31. And so these times for feasting and for dining and for eating in the Bible often serve as the context for covenantal instruction and institution. If you want to write this down, Exodus chapter 24, Moses, there's this kind of opaque reference in Exodus 24 of Moses and the elders going up to Mount Sinai and they eat. Not much more is told us. Leviticus 23 records for us the Feast of Passover, first fruits, weeks, trumpets, to name a few. The New Testament, of course, we hear of the Lord's Supper. We hear of the love feasts in Jude, which probably are the same actual thing. And the marriage supper of the Lamb, which ends the consummation is described as a marriage supper, Revelation 19, 6 through 10. So in all these instances, there is more to a meal than just food, than just fuel, than just feeding. There's physical, spiritual, and social dynamics that are involved. And these events serve to inform us of God's covenantal dealings with his people and his people's dealings with one another. It's that latter point, his people's dealings with one another, that I think is often neglected and that I want to focus with you on this afternoon. Thinking of eating just in general as being broader than just fuel, and thinking of our communion meal together as a church being more, as we'll see, than just vertical, but also including horizontal implications. We'll see, hopefully, at the end of this, the textured and layered nature of the Lord's Supper. Now, my topic, the Lord's Supper as preemptive peacemaking, might seem a bit strange at a conference on biblical counseling. Some of you might be asking the questions, what in the world does the supper have to do with the Bible? How can the supper equip us to become more effective at spreading peace in the church and promoting discipleship in the church? And I hope to answer those questions and see how the Lord's Supper actually can be a really good preemptive means to creating God-glorifying, peaceful churches, okay? A little bit about myself before diving into this material. 2005, I became the pastor of the church that I now pastor. Started off as an intern, then was an assistant, and then became the pastor. To suggest that our church was a powder keg when I took over in 2005 would be a bit of an extreme. But let me just be blunt. It wasn't as peaceful as it could have been. There was all sorts of issues, and it was a little touchy for a while there. One of the first things that we did after I became the pastor is we moved to weekly communion. So we began to observe the Lord's Supper and partake of the Lord's Supper every single week. And I remember standing there in front of the congregation one Sunday and reflecting on the horizontal nature. This is about a year after we'd done that, the horizontal focus of the Lord's Supper. And I began to think to myself, it is amazing that even to this day, our church has been so peaceful. We haven't had hardly any problems. It's been just so peaceful. And I thought to myself, could that be because of the supper? And I thought, nah, it's too easy. That's just too easy. It's maybe coincidental, if there is such a thing. And then I was convicted a little bit that perhaps my view of the supper was too low view of the supper. And I ran to the scriptures and I began to wrestle through, particularly as we'll see, 1 Corinthians 10 through 12. And I'm convinced more than ever that, of course, there are other factors involved. But one of the factors for peace that exists in our church is because of the regular observance of the supper and what forces us to deal not only with God, but also with one another on a weekly basis. And I don't want to advocate weekly communion. I'm not going to labor that. But I'm just saying this is the connection with our church. All right. So some basic suppositions there you see. That I wanted to just make note of. First of all, I will look at this subject with a colored lens. I come from a confessional Presbyterian, Reformed understanding, and that affects the way that I approach this subject. And I know that we all come from variegated backgrounds, so I don't have any theological axe to grind here. I'm going to actually try to focus on what I think all Christians can agree on when it comes to the supper. Now, as far as nomenclature, I'll use the words ordinance, sacrament interchangeably. I don't have any theological axe to grind with those words. I'll use the word Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, Communion, the Supper, and probably a whole host of other ones that I've forgotten for just interchangeably. Okay, so there's no baggage that those words should carry. Now, the place of the supper in church history, or the place of the supper in the church historically. There is some irony here, for me at least, as I thought about this topic, because I've chosen to talk about the Lord's Supper at a conference on peacemaking, and if you know anything about the Lord's Supper and the history of the church, you know what? It's totally been dividing the church, right? So there's just some irony in choosing this topic. During the Reformation, the Reformers fought against the Lutherans, the Catholics, and the Anabaptists. The Lutherans likewise fought against all the other ones with respect to the supper, and some have even suggested that at the very heart of the Reformation were the sacraments. So there is some irony in this. But the point that I want to make here, and this is just a brief point, is that historically, even though there's been nuances and distinctive elements of particular traditions, it is safe to say that Holy Communion has been an element, an important element, in the worship of the churches, in the worship of the church throughout history. So much so that every single denomination, every single branch of Protestantism, even Eastern Orthodoxy in Rome have an aspect of this theology in their church. So much so that if you take away the supper from the church, whatever that gathering is, it ceases to be a church. So this is a very important part of our history. It's a very important part of our worship. And it's in a very important part of what we do when we gather together corporately. Spend a little bit of time on the vertical focus of the supper, and then we'll spend the majority of our time on the horizontal focus. Okay? The vertical focus of the supper, peace with God. The table of the Lord is one of two sacraments in the New Testament instituted by Christ to sign and seal all of his benefits. As signs, these ordinances of the New Testament point us to the redemptive work of Christ. As one theologian writing on the sacraments has commented, it matters little from which theological background one comes, for every school of theological thought and every church speaks of this sacrament, that is the Lord's Supper, as a sensible sign or a symbol. That is the very essence of a sacrament. This is not to say that the sacraments are merely signs or symbols. They are more, but if they were not signs, they could not be more. So when we gather around the table on Sunday, we see and hear the Lord's death proclaimed, 1 Corinthians 11:26. We see the new covenant, 1 Corinthians 11:25. The redemptive work of Christ is put on display for all to see. And of course, 11:24, 1 Corinthians, we are reminded of what Christ has accomplished for us. So the Lord's Supper provides the church with a visible word supporting and strengthening our faith. And this is why it is sometimes called an acted parable. So when we gather together on the Lord's Day, we preach the word, we sing the word, we hear the word, we see the word. The Lord's Supper is not a different gospel word. It's the same gospel word, but think of it like this, that God knows our weakness, he knows our frailty, and he gives to us another means to communicate the gospel to us. It's a wonderful grace gift that God has given to us in accommodating our frailty, our forgetfulness, our dullness, our weakness. The visible word does not only remind us that Christ died for us, though, it also reminds us that we have an intimate union with Christ. Imagine and think with me, of the implications of food going into your body. Similarly, Christ, we're told in the New Testament, is in us. I realize that John chapter 6 is highly charged and debatable when it comes to speaking about the Lord's Supper, but I'm going to quote it anyway. As Jesus says, whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me. There's this union that is pictured in the supper. So at the table, our gracious host not only reminds us that we have peace with God, Romans 5:1, that if God is for us, who can be against us, Romans 8:31, but we're also reminded of our union with Christ. He is in us. And we have been united by faith with him. As food animates the body, so too Christ animates our souls in this wonderful union. But the Holy Supper not only points us backward, that is to Christ's redemptive work, and not only inward to our union with Christ, but it also points us forward. Paul says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." There is an element of forward-looking anticipation to the consummation of all things, the marriage supper of the Lamb. So in summary, the entire work of Christ is masterfully summed up in the supper. We look back, we look present, and we look forward. The entire scope of Christ's work is shown for us as we gather around the table. This is the vertical focus of Holy Communion, the Lord's Supper. When the church gathers around the table to partake of the covenant meal, her eyes are directed away from herself and forced to completely rest and look to Christ. Charles Spurgeon didn't write a lot of hymns, but one of my favorites that I like to use for leading us to the table is amidst us our beloved stands. And these are the last two verses. If now with eyes defiled and dim we see the signs, but see not him, O may his love the scales displace and bid us see him face to face. O glorious bridegroom of our hearts, your present smile a heaven imparts. O lift the veil, if veil there be, let every saint your glory see. So this is the vertical focus. We're reminded of Christ's entire redemptive work on our behalf. Now, the horizontal focus of the supper, peace with one another. The bulk of the material surrounding discussions and treatments of the Lord's Supper usually revolves around one of two things. First of all, it generally revolves around Christ's real presence or lack thereof, okay? And how he can be present and if he's not present and all the nuances that go into the debate. Or it focuses on the vertical relationship or the vertical focus of the supper. The horizontal focus of supper is hard to find. In fact, I only found one chapter in a book that was surveying the reformers' views of communion. I had a hard time finding a whole treatment of the horizontal aspect of the supper in any of the books. It's just not really mentioned because there's not a whole lot of maybe debate going on or perhaps it's just been neglected in our thinking of it. But I want to suggest that if we neglect this aspect of the supper, we neglect an important aspect of what God has given to us in the supper. And also because the horizontal focus is given to us in the New Testament. So we partake of Christ, and when we do so, we not only testify to the world that we are his, but we also proclaim that we are part of his body, the church. Most of your churches, I'm sure, don't just let anyone come to the table. They fence it, the pastors will fence it, or perhaps you do something to ensure that it's Christians that come. I mean, that fact alone testifies that there is something going on here socially, right? That we do this as Christians. We do this together. We don't do this with the world or, you know, anybody that just wants to come. We do this with followers of Christ. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, we have a low or a shrunken view of eating. And this shrunken approach to eating springs from, I'm convinced, the rampant individualism that exists and permeates our culture. And sadly, the evangelical church has not been immune from this permeation. And the effects can easily be seen throughout the church. What this means is that we need to reflect on and think long and hard about the communal nature of eating in general, as well as specifically relating to the covenant meal. I mentioned Leon Cass in the introduction. He says, man does not live by bread alone, neither does he like to take it alone, all by himself. And similarly, the Holy Supper is a meal that is never eaten alone. It is only eaten when the church gathers publicly for worship. I'll just say this. I hope I'm not offending anyone. But there is a practice that I think sort of suggests individualism, especially when it comes to the supper. And that is the practice of brides and grooms taking communion at weddings. And if you're like me, I sort of sit there when I see that. I want to raise my hand and say, what about me? You know, I want some. Because there's this communal focus. It's not designed for you know, I'm a minister. I serve the supper every Sunday, but I never serve it at home to my family. I mean, there's a communal aspect to the supper. And we got to realize that we've been pretty infected by individualism. We've been taught it from a very young age. And it permeates even what we do in the church. So the communion meal focuses our attention vertically. It reminds us that we have peace with God and exhorts us to pursue that peace, but it does the same horizontally. And so when we come to the table, we testify that we've been reconciled with God, but we also testify that we have been reconciled with our brothers and sisters. Now, I think this is just so axiomatic that we sometimes miss it. I mean, if you got an argument with somebody, you just have a hard time even being around this room. This person has just made you so angry. Are they the first person you're going to call and have lunch with? Of course not. Why would you want to have lunch with that person? You're angry with them, and you don't want to sit across the table with them and look them in the eye. It'd be a very awkward conversation. Similarly, it's inconceivable that Christ Church would gather when they can't look at each other in the eye. So it forces us to deal with issues when rightly understood. It expresses our unity that we have with one another when we gather around the table. Again, Leon Cass, I'll quote him again, is helpful and reminds us that there is more to the meal than simply sustenance. To be at table means that one has removed oneself from business and motion and made a commitment to spend some time over one's meal. One commits oneself not only to time, but also to an implicit plan of eating. We sit to eat, and not just to feed, and to do so both according to a plan and with others. So when we come to the table, we're not just coming to eat, but we're coming to spend time with others. Now, it's interesting that the most extended treatment of the Lord's Supper in the Scriptures is found in 1 Corinthians. And if you know anything about Corinthians, you know that it is a church that was fraught with social conflict. As one author has said, Paul mediated that conflict by reference to the Lord's Supper. And the heart of that treatment comes in 1 Corinthians 10 through 12, where interestingly enough, and we're going to look at this in just a second, Paul calls the church the body of Christ. A lot of people suggest and think that that's sort of a way to press ethical implications upon them, because Jesus, you remember on the night that he was betrayed, broke the bread and said what? This is my body. And now Paul says, you're his body. There's this ethical overtones in Paul's even use of the body in that whole section, as we'll see in just a moment. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11:18, for in the first place when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions, schismata. There are schisms among the church. And these divisions were most clearly being manifested at the table, sadly. If you have your Bibles, 1 Corinthians 11, I'll spend a little time here and see how this section unfolds. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Well, 17 through 22 is where he highlights the problem and the divisions that exist. But in the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. And I believe it in part, for there must be factions among you in order that you who are genuine, those who are genuine among you may be recognized. When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who shall have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you for this? Or commend you in this? No, I will not. And then he, in verses 23 through 26, recounts those words of institution. And then finally we hear the admonishment for the church to take the implications of social chaos very seriously. Now, verse 27, we hear about eating the supper, eating the bread, and drinking the cup in an unworthy manner. Verse 28, Paul calls the church to examine themselves. And in verse 29, a very debated and talked about, especially in these days, text. He says that anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. The question, of course, for us is what does that mean? What does it mean? What's it look like, I should say, to partake of the supper in an unworthy manner? How should you examine yourself when you come to the supper? And what does it mean to discern the Lord's body? The majority, I think, of the exegetical material that is written on the subject suggests that coming to the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner is perhaps coming harboring sin. So you must examine yourself. That is, you know, you sort of do this deep introspection and say, you know, maybe I shouldn't have spoken to my wife and kids like that on the way to church, you know, this kind of thing. And then discerning the body is actually understanding Christ's work and Christ's redemptive work and understanding how the elements relate to Christ's redemptive work and what's going on in the supper. However, I sort of wonder if that's what Paul has in mind. Because as we reflect upon the context, what is particularly interesting to me is that there are social problems going on here. So the most natural way of understanding it would be coming to the table in an unworthy manner, would be fighting with your brother or sister. Examine yourself to see if you have any issues that you need to deal with. And then, of course, what does that mean to discern the body? I want to suggest that it means that you rightly understand who the body, the church, is, and you rightly understand your place in it. In 1 Corinthians 10 through 11, every reference to the body or body in 1 Corinthians 10, 11, and 12 is to the church, with one exception, and that is 11:24, where the words of institution are recounted for us. If you take a look at 1 Corinthians 10, verse 17, for example, Paul says, "Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body." And then chapter 12, it just runs over and over and over again. We've been baptized into one body. We're one body over and over again. But perhaps the clearest statement is in 12:27. "Now you are the body of Christ and individually members of it." This leads commentator Gordon Fee to make this statement. "Most likely the term body, even though it comes by way of the words of institution in verse 24, deliberately recalls Paul's interpretation of the bread in 10:17, thus indicating that the concern is with the problem in Corinth itself, of the rich abusing the poor. All the evidence seems to point in this direction. But the meaning of that body at this table is that those who eat of the one loaf are themselves that one body. Why the absolute use of body in this sentence should mean something different from what Paul himself says it means is what needs to be explained if he intended something different." Of course, for Paul, the cross is always in view. 1 Corinthians 2:2, "I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." But the shadow of that cross has social implications, social aspects of the gospel, namely reconciliation, not just between us and God, but also between one another, as, of course, you know well from this conference and the materials being written on the subject. You probably have heard of the historic practice of the church. I don't know how your churches are, but at our church, we use the little plastic cups for the supper. I mean, logistically, pragmatically, that's what we've chosen to do. But the historic practice of the church was one cup, and they fought about that. And some of the reasons they fought about it was because it was a means to emphasizing unity and the emphasis of sharing in one cup and sharing in one loaf as one body. So I see Paul saying here in 1 Corinthians 11 that when brothers and sisters come to the table unreconciled, then the supper is eaten in an unworthy manner. And the body of Christ, the church, is not properly discerned, and we can expect 11:32, God's discipline, which is awfully scary. It's not really surprising, though, because if we continue to live unreconciled to our brothers and sisters, we should expect God's judgment as well. And, or maybe discipline is a better word. He seems to reiterate that very point here. And thus, a person ought to examine himself, that he first be reconciled to his brother or sister. The verse that kept ringing in my mind as I've been thinking through this is Matthew 5:24, where Jesus makes that startling claim, you know, instead of going to worship, go first be reconciled. I think there's a relationship here between 1 Corinthians 11 and Matthew 5:24. Leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. It's unthinkable that we would partake of a common meal with a friend or an acquaintance that we're upset with, and it's unthinkable that we would partake of a holy meal with those that we are upset with. All right, so the importance of keeping these two focuses present. I mean, the obvious reason that we need to keep these focuses present is because the Bible keeps them present. I mean, the Bible points us vertically and also horizontally when we come to the table. But I think it's important for us to remember that this is how the Apostle Paul brings the gospel together. You think of Ephesians chapter 2, for example, verses 13 through 17, where the Apostle Paul talks about being reconciled with God and then having this reconciliation spill over between the Jews and the non-Jews, the Greeks, in that church. Some of you perhaps have heard of the new perspective on Paul. The new perspective on Paul suggests that the justification is mostly revolving around social implications. That is, it produces the social peace within the church and has these social implications. I think rightly so, that's been called into question, and we're reminded that it has not just social implications, but has implications for our right standing with God, and that is at the heart of justification. But sometimes in our defense of that, we can easily neglect the social implications that exist with respect to the gospel, with respect to justification, that it creates peace with one another, and it creates peace with God, or perhaps we should get our order correct. It creates peace with God first, and it creates peace with one another. So if we emphasize one without the other, I want to suggest that we have a deficient view of the supper, and we need to keep them closely together so that we might have our people be energized to be reconciled with one another, even as God has been reconciled to us. The supper as gospel word. I mentioned earlier that it has been described as an acted parable. And Keith Matheson has put it like this: the Lord's Supper is a visible sermon in which Christ's death is visibly proclaimed. The gospel is our only hope, reconciliation with God, who's outraged by our sin. But more than just being a sort of ethereal idea, it gives way to tangible fruit, and that is reconciliation with others. So, for example, we don't merely hear the command, forgive. We just don't find in the Bible, forgive. We find things like, forgive each other as the Lord has forgiven you. We don't just find commands, say, husbands, love your wives. We find commands, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. We find, like Luke chapter 7, for example, the woman that was forgiven much, who loved much, and the one who was forgiven little loves little. We find these put together. And so I wonder, is it a stretch to think that when people get gripped by the mercy of God, they might also be merciful to others? Is it a stretch to think that if husbands could really understand Christ's love for his church, they might actually have that love spill over into their love for their wives. Is it a stretch to imagine that a church who understands the forgiveness of sins so deeply would be willing to forgive very quickly those who have offended them and ask for forgiveness? I don't think it is. And I think this is why the Lord's Supper is wonderfully preemptive when it comes to peacemaking. Because it constantly drives home to us the good news of the gospel so that when somebody comes to us and wrongs us, we say, I've wronged God so much more than you did to me. I willingly will forgive you. There is no bitterness that is harbored whatsoever. So, I guess what I'm saying in all of this is two things. We don't need to get cute with gimmicks. The real power of transformation comes from the gospel. That's what you know, and maybe I'm just reminding you of that. And the second thing is, let's preach the gospel in the way that God intended us to preach the gospel and told us to preach the gospel, through His Word and through the visible Word, through the ordinary means. And then let's sit back and trust Him to do His work. Because generally, when we lean upon Him and do things His way, He does His work, His way, for His people. And that's exactly what I'm saying here. All right, let me give you four implications, and then we can discuss more about this in the time remaining. Okay, four pastoral and practical implications, as I see it. The first is study and instruct your people about the theology of the supper, both vertical and theological. So when I wrote that, I thought to myself, well, perhaps not everybody in this is going to be a pastor, so that might not be a relevant point. But I think it is, because all of you have some influence. You're here for a reason. So you can encourage people to understand the Lord's Supper better, whether you're a pastor, whether you're a husband, whether you're in a mentoring relationship. Secondly, encourage your people to faithfully avail themselves to the means of grace. That's a way that we speak of the Lord's Supper and prayer and preaching. I mean, I don't know about you and the people you interact with, but I'm sure they're the same as the ones I do. People really need to be told that if you miss church to stay home and watch football, that will affect you spiritually. People need to understand that if they miss church to go to their kid's soccer game, that will affect you spiritually. And so encourage folks to avail themselves faithfully to the means that God has given to us to be strengthened. The Word, sacrament/ordinances, prayer. There you go. I was meeting just before I came up here today. I had to meet a counseling session with one of our members who's really struggling, a young lady. And I've been noticing that her church attendance has been sporadic. And so it was the first thing. I mean, we're working on other things, and I gave her some other things to do, but I encouraged her. Get in church every Sunday. Sit under the preaching, even though it's not that good. sit under the preaching. Come feed upon Christ in the supper. Pray, unite your hearts in prayer as we pray together. Sing, and let's see what God might do. Third, preach if you can. If you're a preacher, teach. If you have any sort of hearing, even if it's just your kids or your spouse or your friends, preach, preach, preach against individualism. Individualism just sucks people dry. And it's just almost nowhere to be found in the New Testament. I found it interesting that even though Paul does reference individuals in 1 Corinthians 11, he just comes right back to us and says, you're individual members of the body. So individuality sort of gives way to the communal nature of the church. And we got to continually fight that. And then fourth, and this goes back to what I started earlier, try to get your church to observe the supper regularly. Because it's an opportunity for the gospel to continually be in front of you, not only in your ear, but also with your eyes. So there we go, the Lord's Supper as preemptive peacemaking. Questions or comments on anything that I've said? Yeah. Yes.
But then you tithes when things were going good.
Yeah.
This is what moves us to do it weekly.
What moves us to do it weekly?
Other than the Spirit of the Lord.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the context of why we went weekly. I think we got a letter from a member who just was encouraging us to do that, and the elder started to talk about it and kind of looked at the subject and looked at the Bible and thought, boy, there's really no good reason not to. That was kind of, we kind of fell into it, honestly.
Well, yeah.
I mean, in a you know, sanctified kind of way. So, yeah. Yeah. It's been. I really do think that has been a real blessing, and that God has used that in our congregation, as we gather around the table every week together, and that's now. You know, the argument that it gets routine, but I just... Yeah, exactly. It's routine. So, anyway. What else? Questions, comments? Yeah.
During the Lord's Supper, what do you guys do with the...
What do we do?
During the distribution.
Yeah.
Say the bread.
Yeah.
What's the congregation
do? Well, there's music playing, and the elders distribute the bread.
So there's no congregation singing?
No, we don't sing. Not that I'm opposed to.
But that's the way it's been since you've been there. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that in the way most of our traditions, Reformed, Presbyterians, practice the Lord's Supper, especially since it's based on an understanding of 1 Corinthians 11, which is very individualistic, that the practice of taking the Lord's Supper is very individualistic, with the exception of if we all wait.
Right.
And then we all do it together.
Right.
That's an emphasis of we're doing this together.
Right.
But, you know, in this very thing where if you're, you know, take what you're saying to heart, you know, this very thing which is minimally reminding that we're united and joined together, that's when we don't look at each other or talk to each other.
Yeah. When I first came to New Life, we had one of our elders would always lean over and he'd say, you know, the body of Christ broken for you. I'd never heard anybody speak during communion. So, and one of the other things, too, and this is just my thoughts on this, but I'll oftentimes, I'll serve our elders, and I'll oftentimes, you know, say a kind word to them. I'll smile. Because this, for me, I don't see it as a time of, but rather a celebration. A time, I mean, obviously, within celebration, oftentimes there's tears and conviction and joy and different emotions. But it doesn't just have to be. Somber. It can be interaction, engaging. There can be. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's a foretaste of what's to come. Can we imagine sitting at the Lamb's table?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean that's an interesting point. And you think about all the things that I said, just from you know, removed from the Holy Supper, just in eating in general, the interaction that goes on. So we've got. I don't know how that might look or how that might work, you know, but that's a very, very good point.
No, I'm trying to lose that way, but we sing now.
Mm.
So that we're not just left individually to introspection.
Yeah.
We handle sin when we come at the beginning of the service.
Right, as do we. That's right.
We're coming to the Lord's table to confess sin.
Right, right.
Okay, but when we come to the Lord's table, then instead of just... Well, some people put it, you know, look at your spiritual belly button and check for Lent. You know, we're at least focusing our thoughts in a common way in praising the Lord.
Yeah.
And so we try to at least turn our thoughts to Christ, or we'll be singing about the church and the unity of the church. I mean, we try to, and so this has been relatively new to us, to, well, we used to not even have musical accompaniment. It was just dead silence.
Hmm. That's great. Any, yeah.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
One, and I've done this twice in my career, walking the Lord. When communion came by, my heart was not.
Was that what?
The proper thing to
well, speaking. Yeah, speaking for myself, here's my view, and I'm sure that there'll be different views in this, but I'm just since you asked. I don't think it's proper for individuals to remove themselves from the communion table or the meal. I think that's a job for the elders to do. So that's just me. Now, if we're properly shepherding our people, there is aspects of discipline. That's an aspect of discipline, removing, censuring somebody from the table. So I think, look, if a sin or the lack thereof is a requirement to come to the table, how many of us would come?
We're coming there because of what we're celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. So now rebellion, if you want to argue, you're rebellious and you're angry, well, that's a different story. But I think sometimes we're too introspective and not looking away from ourselves. I think the supper just says, don't even look away, look away, look away. So that would be my answer to that. What's the second question? So you want me to comment on that? Well, I would not recommend that. Just speaking bluntly, I wouldn't advocate. Again, I think the communion meal is a corporate meal that we celebrate when we come together as a church. So we don't. This is their church. Well, yeah. I mean, I was in a Bible study. I was leading this Bible study down in Ocean Beach. If you know anything about San Diego, Ocean Beach is kind of lowbrow, grungy beach area. And I showed up one night, and the guy walks. We're all sitting there, and the guy comes after music. He comes walking in. He's got a bottle of wine in his hand, a loaf of bread. And he goes, "We're celebrating communion." No, we're not. So I'm not. I don't advocate, you know, small group communion, that kind of stuff. And I am Presbyterian, so I do think that there is, God has, I'd be okay with elders probably, but elders, God is entrusted to oversee the church, so I'd probably want an elder to do that, if that's their church, or at least encourage them to get, we can talk more, maybe about the specifics on that, so that would be my thoughts on that. Yeah?
Just a side question. Housebound people.
Shut-ins and people with extended stays in hospital, for example, or something like that. Those are the exceptions, and we should accommodate them accordingly. I don't want to make the exception the rule, of course. So.
Basically, when that question's been brought up, I said, "Well, let's ask the elders if they want to meet there as a church."
That's what we do. That's what we do. That's what we do. We had a woman in our church who was, she was in the hospital for a long time, and then she specifically requested. So we had the elders and the deacons go as sort of a visible manifestation of the church, and we all served her communion. So that's what I would say. Yeah. Serve the supper. Oh, I don't know. Can I defer to you on that, Jim? No. I don't know. For me, I just thought it was a good way for us to represent the representatives of the church gathering. So.
I think it's really good that churches wrestle these things through and think them through, and we may not come to exactly the same place. I like your reasoning of saying rather than just one guy going, at least
it looks a little like being a priest.
Yeah.
In a Roman Catholic sense, whereas if more than one comes, it's like part of the church anyway, doing that with the individual. But I think it's good that people are thinking about it. And then you may come to the conclusion that I'm not completely comfortable,
sure,
or vice versa, but I respect that people are really trying.
And we should be gracious in these situations because, I mean, come on, there are exceptions for a reason, and exceptions are difficult, so, because the Bible generally doesn't give us, rules for exceptions, it gives us the norm, so, but good question. Anything else, thoughts or comments?
You got a bunch of pastors in here, actually.
Do I? Okay. Who else?
What means do you use to prevent it?
I don't know that we do anything specific, actually. Occasionally I have. Not.
It shouldn't be necessary, but our sinfulness makes it necessary. We get reminded.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've found is that whereas sometimes you'll hear pastors give long introductions about the supper and almost like a mini sermon. I just figure we do this every week. I don't need to do that. So I actually try to apply different aspects of the sermon to lead in. So that's kind of how I handle it. But with respect to why we do it, not directly. However, I do write a 500-word, I can't call it an essay. What do you want to call it? 500-word treatment, let's say, of why it's called Why We Do What We Do. And I just do something different of our servants every week. And so that's...
Did you construct your whole service to which that's the apex of your...
The communion?
Is everything leading up to that?
I don't know that I would say that. Our service is constructed more around the word. I alluded to this earlier, but it's pray the word, sing the word, preach the word, see the word, and that's an aspect of doing that. So, but it kind of does. I mean, we do have confession of sin, assurance of pardon, preaching, and then we come to the table. So. It's the last part of. We do weekly communion, but we alternate it morning and evening. So first and third morning, second and fourth evening, and so on the fifth Sundays we do it in the morning. So it's the last part of our service. We go right into doxology. There's a little tiny book that you might want to pick up. It's fairly good. I disagree with this association between the Passover and the Lord's Supper. This author does not associate the Lord's Supper with the Passover. He associates it with that meal in Exodus 24. Robert Lethem, Lethem, little tiny paperback. And he does do a nice treatment of unleavened bread, wine, etc. in there, which is good. So our church uses leavened bread. In fact, we had people leave over, if you can believe that. We had people leave over leavened bread. So no, I don't think it matters.
I had one man leave over plastic versus glass.
Really?
No.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Plastic over glass.
Plastic, you toss it.
Right. I've never seen glass. He won a glass, huh?
Yeah, they're little, just like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Lord's Supper is preemptive peacemaking, right? Maybe I got to open my head on this one. Well, if we preach big gospel and lift up Christ, I think those sort of things just fall by the wayside. So, all right. Well, thank you for having me, and may the Lord bless you as you think through these issues, and have a good afternoon.